KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver.
Support comes from the Southwest Native American Foundation. For two decades, the foundation has been providing scholarships for universities and graduate schools to students of the tribes of the Southwest, reminding you that this year, Colorado Gives Day is Tuesday, December 9th. More information can be found at swnaf.org.
Support comes from the Denver Justice and Peace Committee, a grassroots organization working to educate and advocate for human rights in Latin America. More information at denjustpeace.org.
Welcome to Hemispheres on KGNU. On today's episode, we sit down with Reverend Atekpatsin, an Isaro Apache historian, educator, and founder of the framework known as Gringismo, to explore how white supremacy, capitalism, and Christianity shape life in Boulder and beyond, and what indigenous liberation epistemology offers as a path forward. And then we turn our attention to the Laura Gonzalez case, a local indigenous activist now facing criminal charges for demanding a ceasefire and calling out genocide in Gaza. We hear from her attorney, Cameron Bedard, who offers grounding legal context and his perspective on whether this case is winnable. Let's go.
We are absolutely honored to have the Reverend Atekpatsin of the Indigenous People Church with us. We're in for a real conversation of what Gringismo is and how that impacts us. He is the founder of Gringismo. His analysis sits at the intersection of capitalism and settler colonialism and how those two work together. And so we're not going to come out with any answers here, but we're certainly today are going to get much closer than we have in the past. And with that, Reverend, and I'm going to refer you as a reverend because I do go to your church and I want the audience to know that I go to your church. We also have Ruckus. We can't forget the Ruckus. Thank you, Ruckus, for joining us. So with that, Reverend, I'd like to open up the floor to let the audience know who you are.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation. Our community is constantly doing the work necessary to, there are two objectives. The first objective is to dismantle Gringismo, and the second objective is to empower members of the community. And probably for the sake of the audience, I should define what Gringismo is. When I write about Gringismo, I use this word intentionally. Now, very, very simply told, if you're speaking Spanish, when you say Gringismo, it means that which gringos do. And then there are three aspects of Gringismo that I frame within this context. And the first is white supremacy, obviously. The second is capitalism. And the third is Christianity. These three things work together to assure that the white community is privileged. White people, from the time they're born, they are groomed to defend, to protect, support, and promote white supremacy. That is Gringismo. And that doesn't happen without the support of their God. And that's what Christianity does for them. God gives them permission to do the egregious things they do against other communities, and then simultaneously forgives them for doing such horrible things, right? So that's the purpose and the function of their religion. And embedded within that religion is this idea, if you go back into the Bible and you read Genesis, Adam and Eve are cast out of the Garden of Eden. And so this requires a savior to come and fix them. And so anyone that's born into this world is born broken and requires a white man to save them, a savior of some sort. And everything is structured this way. When you go to the doctor is the savior, and you are broken, and the doctor is going to fix you. So medicine, schooling, everything around how white culture is structured is founded in this idea of broken people needing to be fixed. and requiring a savior. So that's the religious part. And then the third, obviously, is capitalism, which is a notion that traditionally for indigenous people is pretty foreign. And let me just contextualize that. People in Boulder think that they own the land they're on because they paid for it, they bought it. Now, they've never paid us. I'm from here. My ancestors are from here. This is our land. I know everyone wants to believe that this is Cheyenne and Arapaho land. The problem with that belief is that the Cheyenne and the Arapaho arrived here into this territory as refugees from the Great Lakes area. They were fleeing the French Indian War. So they got here in the early 1800s. But when the English speakers arrived here, that's who they encountered. And so they just assumed that they had always been here and been here forever. Now, if you ask them, they might tell you that, but that's just not true. And we have all the evidence, the interviews and the histories that reinforce the idea that they arrived here in the 1800s. They know this. And they displaced the people that were here. Now, this whole area in Boulder has been a lot of movement since the onset of colonization. But the first people to colonize the area were not the English speakers. They were the Castellano speakers or Spanish speakers. They came up from the South and they introduced the slave trade. And that introduction to the slave trade changed everything here. And that's one of the things about gringismo is that people are just objects. They have an extractive philosophy. A thing only has value if you can profit off of it. A tree has no worth or value unless you cut it down. And so when we think about our relationship as indigenous people to this land and to this space, I like to give the analogy of a bear. I lived up against Flagstaff Mountain for 30 years, and the bears would come into the yard all the time. They poop in the yard, then just move on, right? Get into the trash cans. Bears do what bears do. And you can't think about living in Boulder up against mountains without realizing that we are in bear territory. The bears are not separate from the land. We as indigenous people are not separate from the land either. We don't own it. We're a part of it. We are the land. The land is us. We're not separate from each other. So the idea of capitalism doesn't play any role in that. And that's how we regard ourselves relative to the land and the places that we live on. That's my introduction. When we're talking about gringismo, what are we talking about? We're talking about an ethos, a cosmology, a way of moving in the world that views everyone and everything as potential for profit, that get permission by their God to do horrible things to other communities, and privileges white people. Very succinctly, in a long story, that's what gringismo is. So that's what we're talking about today.
You named the three pillars of gringismo: white supremacy, yes, capitalism, and Christianity. And I would like to explore Christianity, because I think one of the major pillars of the work that you've engaged in is actually reclaiming spirituality or spirituality on the land as a way for people to engage with the notion of sovereignty, to find their sovereignty. One of the conversations that I've engaged in is that marginalized communities, through the mechanisms and the machinations of gringismo, have a learned helplessness, this idea that they cannot have sovereignty. How do you approach the empowerment of the individual through spirituality?
Religion has a function in the world, and not just Christianity, but all religions. And one of the primary functions, so one of the human fears that we have is that we're going to die. Nobody wants to die. We're afraid of dying. And religion, what it does is it helps to assuage that fear by promising fantastical things that happen after death. In truth, and I'm going to give two truths. The first truth is there is no God. And the second, there is no life after death. But if I promise you life after death and promise you there's a God, then what I can do is I can get you to submit, which is the other purpose of all religions, is to get you to submit. You're going to do what I tell you to do. And that makes for an orderly society. And that's the function of it. So what I'm telling people, there is no God. And so when people say, talk about God, I say, well, I don't know anything about God, but neither does anybody else. But here's the thing, and I tell people, kill your God. When you kill your God, you free yourself. You free yourself from all the impositions that are really man-made religious impositions about who you should and should not be. If you're born queer in this world today, You're born queer. That's all there is to it. But religions have a lot to say about that and how you should express that and how you should walk in the world and how you should somehow or the other change who you really are. And that's problematic. That really is problematic. So we create all these constructions that a lot of times are rooted in the cosmologies of our religious beliefs. Christianity is one of the worst because, you know, what's interesting is you talk to some of our people, and I was teaching the class of brown kids, and I said, how many Christians are there in here? Raise your hands. And a few of them raised their hands. I said, how many Catholics? And all their hands went up. They don't make a distinction between the two. And they don't realize all Christian beliefs, all Christian religions started with the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church, here's an interesting thing about the Catholic Church. At a time when there are monarchies all across Europe, you have all these kings, usually kings, sometimes queens, but usually kings dictating to the people that live in these territories what they can and cannot do. In essence, the people are subjects of the king. They don't even own their own lives. They are properties of the kings. And then something new pops up, and it's this idea of the church. The church has no militaries. The church has really no territory other than what's provided it by other places. But it had something unique that none of the monarchies had. And it was an idea of God. And they sold this idea of God. And if you buy into the church and you're one of us, then you get our blessing for all the things, all the horrible things that you do. And the church was backed. So with this one simple idea of God and religion, the church managed to control monarchies, control kings, and control how the world was shaped. Because from that became all of this colonization around the world, colonizing other areas. And the church granted permission to do that because it says, if you arrive to a place and you claim it for your monarchy and you claim it for the church, the Catholic Church, you have the right to enslave the people, to take whatever their resources are, to rape the women, to do whatever you want, and the church will back you. You are following God's law. What an incredible assertion. What an incredible idea. So it's just an idea, but it's a powerful idea. So the moment that you're born into a family, your parents, whatever their religious belief, starts to impose upon your thinking onto this voice in your head that you have to do what you're told. You need to submit first to your parents, and you need to submit to all these other authorities that you encounter through the course of your life. We had someone, unfortunately, in the last couple of weeks that took their life, a two-spirit person. And my thought is that somehow or the other, that voice inside this person's head got the better of them. And the voice is a simple voice, and it says, you're not worthy. You're not worthy to be here. You're not worthy to be who you are. You don't belong in this world. And when we begin to believe that voice, then we choose not to be in this world. How much more powerful can you be than to convince someone else that they're not worthy and to put the gun to their own head? You don't even have to pull a trigger. You don't have to kill them. You get them to kill themselves. That's the voice that religion puts in your head. So when I'm empowering people, what am I doing? I'm silencing that voice. I'm telling people, don't listen to that voice. Don't believe that stuff. That's just not true. In indigenous beliefs, we are all a part of the circle. We all have a place within the circle. And no one has any right to tell you that you do or do not belong. You have a place in the circle. We don't know what it is, and we may not always agree with it, but hey, here you are, right? I don't like mosquitoes, but they have a function in the world. And so that's the voice we have to silence. That and that's the place where we begin. I was a part of the Chicano movement when I was very, very young, as was my mother. She was a leader, a political leader in the Chicano movement. To talk a little bit about my mother, she was 14 years old and forced to marry a man who was several years older than she was. She was a child. but he raped her, got her pregnant, and so she married him. The baby didn't survive, and he took off to the army, and she was forced to go live with his family. Here she is, a teenager, and she had no control over her life because my grandmother, her mother-in-law, absolutely dictated everything that she did. She stays with my father for a number of years. And finally, when I'm 12 years old, my father leaves for another woman. At that point, for the first time in her life, my mother found her voice. She didn't realize that what she thought or what she wanted to say had any relevance, because she was taught as a woman that she had no voice and had no relevance. And she became involved in the Chicano movement and made sure that she was always asserting the rights of Chicanas, of the women, against the men. But she was not a part of the white women's movement, because she said the white women want us to hate men. She said, our men are suffering the same oppression that we as women are suffering. We're not free unless our men are also free. So the battle is not with our men. The battle is with gringismo. So let's be clear about who the enemy is here. And so my mother was always very clear about that. And so I followed her in that process. I followed her in the work, and I've continued the work that she did. And she was following the work that her father did back in the 30s, around the time of the Great Depression. And so, and this is a continuation. I can trace my history back to 1697, mm-hmm. right here in this territory, in this area. And we have never stopped. As Indigenous people, we have stopped fighting against the invasion of our territory, against the theft of our family members, against the impositions and the laws, and against the Catholic Church and against Christianity for what they've done to our people, horrendous things that they've done to our people. So this is how I contextualize it. So what are we doing? When I take people into a circle to pray, it's not about God. It's about empowering them and reminding them, you come from a lineage. A strong lineage of resistance, a strong lineage of resilience, and a strong lineage connected to this land. And as a consequence, it is imperative that you connect with that you inculcate that, you silence that voice that's telling you you're not worthy, and that you walk with your head up and you walk with pride, and you don't let anyone tell you what to do, that you walk as a sovereign. That's what we're doing, and I have to do it through our rituals and our ceremonies, because that's where people reconnect with who they are, right? None of the religions, the foreign religions, do that. They don't connect people with who they are. They connect people with the idea that you need to submit to authority. And that's not what we're doing. I'm not in the business of telling people what to do. What I do attempt to do is empower them so that they can silence that negative voice in their head and walk with their heads up.
You're listening to Hemispheres on KGNU. We're having a conversation with Aztec Paxin, Genisaro Apache, Corandero, Reverend, and Scholar about gringismo, spirituality, and making a new world.
So let's talk a little bit about your mother, because one of the things that I appreciated and wanted to know more about her, your mom was also a part of the Communist Party.
Yes, she was.
And there's not a lot of examples of women of color, Indigenous and Black women, who actually have taken up that particular mantle. One of the things that I heard you talk about and that I've read also is the impact of her beliefs and being a communist and how that led to her being ousted from CU Boulder. Can you talk about your mom's participation in the Communist Party? I'd love to hear about your mom's work, and if we do have a chance in this moment to achieve some type of reciprocity, gift economy, alternative economy outside of capitalism.
I remember I was about 13 years old, and there was a conference in Rocky Ford, Colorado. My mother, when my father left, my mother, she worked in doctor's offices, cleaning them. She used to do laundry for people. My mother did whatever she could to make money. But at some point, she managed to get a job with the War on Poverty, which was Johnson's War on Poverty. And we were really impressed with my mother because she had her own office, right? She worked out of that office. And mostly what she did is she worked in a tri-county area. So Otero County, Bend County, one of the others, and she's working with farm workers. So she's on the front line visiting with, dealing with the farm workers and the horrendous conditions that the farmers put them under. They are providing us our food. They're doing the hard work and the farm workers are treating them horrible. My mother's work was such that on two occasions, they tried to assassinate my mother, these farm workers. And they did it by trying to run her off the road and total the vehicles. And so this was serious. We were at war in the late 60s, early 70s. And I remember the first time we went to a conference in Rocky Ford, and my mother got up and spoke. She had an opportunity. Corky Gonzalez was there, Len Avila was there, all these people who were part of the movement, the Colorado movement at the time. And she got up and spoke, and there was a tremor in her voice because she was terrified. No one had ever listened to her. No one ever, you know, she didn't think she had permission to speak. But she got up there, and with tremor in her voice, she spoke, and she said what she needed to say. And her message was always the same. We as women have an equal footing here. And she continued that work. And she earned a place for herself across the Chicano movement. There was a point when our family was arrested. We had moved to the Arkansas Valley and we were arrested and the whole family, there were about 9 to 13 people that were arrested that night. And my mother ends up in jail. She was there for a couple of weeks. I was in jail there for a month. And Corky Gonzalez contacted us and said, we'll come and we'll support you and we'll do this work. But this is how we'll do it. And my mother said, I don't need you here. We can do this on our own. So she was not going to let some man who was a part of the Chicano movement, who thought he got to make all the decisions, she was not going to let him tell her what to do. And she always said that. She said, put it on my grave. I never let anyone tell me what to do. Well, you know, that's not on her gravestone. It's her message. And so in her involvement, she continued the involvement. One of the things that was happening in the early 90s at the time that she was a part of the Communist Party was some woman by the name of Linda Chavez, an absolute sellout, is backing a movement to make English the law of the land. So Colorado has a law. It's called the English Only Law. And all it says is English will be the official language of the state. But it is racism. It's absolute racism. And so my mother got up and she spoke out against that. But in the work that my mother did, she was always working with groups of people. And in that work, she got involved with some people who were part of the Communist Party here and out in California. Collectively, this is in the late 80s, actually, she decided to go out to Nicaragua. And so she went with a group of people from the Communist Party, from the Chicano community, who went out to Nicaragua to go support the revolution that was happening down there. When she got back, CU, she worked at the University of Colorado, they fired her immediately. Not because there was anything problematic other than the politics, her politics, right? And she wasn't taking that to work. That wasn't what she was doing. But they were not going to allow a woman who was a communist, a woman who was revolutionary, a woman who had gone into another country to support their revolution. They weren't going to allow her to continue to work there. So my mother always struggled to work and struggled to support four children. And she did fine. She raised us fine. We grew up very poor, but we grew up with a strong moral code and a good sense of who we are and who we were. And I appreciate having received that gift from my mother. So, yes.
Do you see any particular hope and understanding that, all that you witnessed, right? Your mother's struggle in terms of trying to access and achieve communism here in the States and going out into support. Do you see a pathway towards that in this moment?
Well, you know, my mother joined the Communist Party because in part that's the group that she was involved with and that's what they were doing and they were doing good work. But she didn't stay with it. In the same way, Angela Davis was also a part of the communist movement early on back in the 70s. And I met Angela Davis. I sat at her feet while she was talking here to Chicano students. I'm young. I'm 16, 17 years old and mm-hmm. listening to Angela mm-hmm. Davis talk. And so I got to meet a lot of the people in the movements that I was in with the American Indian movement, the Chicano movement. And then later on, very much a part of the gay movement. It used to be the gay lib movement and it's changed its name over time. So I've been a part of all these movements and my mother was too. But in her later years, my mother became a part of this spiritual movement that we are a part of. We went to our first Sweat Lodge ceremony back in about the late 70s. I think Wallace Black Elk ran that ceremony. There was the longest walk that was happening from Los Angeles all the way to Washington, D.C., and they took a Chinook and gave it to President Carter. And some of them passed through. We were both in school in at the University of Colorado at the time in Southern Colorado in Pueblo. And we housed some of those people that passed through on that walk. And while they were there for a few days, they held ceremonies. We went into a Sweat Lodge ceremony with Wallace Black Elk. And this comes on the heels of Wounded Knee. And one of the women that was involved, my tia, my aunt, that was very much involved with my mother, was Coneja. We Connie Minhares, and we called her Coneja. She married, during the time of Wounded Knee and the occupation there, she married Carter Camp. So she came back with all these stories. So what happened, what Wounded Knee did and the AIM movement did is it helped Chicano people and brown people who were not tribally enrolled to recognize their indigeneity and to embrace some form of that. And the first form, I've always said the Lakotas are missionaries. They're out there spreading their Sweat Lodge ceremonies every place. And so that was our first introduction, if you will, to a spiritual way of life, the Red Road. It has changed and morphed, and even though what my tio said to me when he instructed me to start running the Temalitzlis, the Mexica Sweat Lodge ceremonies, he says, the Lakota have done a lot for us, but we're not Lakota. We need to run our own ceremonies. So I wrote the book recently, published the last couple of years, called Mexicayo. And what I attempted to do in the book was to collect these ideas of what it is to practice Mexicayot. And it's all kinds of stuff. It's curanderismo, which is traditional healing. It is the Sweat Lodge ceremonies. It is the sun dance. It is the danza azteca. All these things that people do that are part of, that fall under this rubric or this umbrella of Mexicayot. And I refer to it as a religion, although I'm not promoting any gods here. It is something that's ancient, that's very old. We're going back 500 years to what was written and what our ancestors had to say about this perspective and this cosmology. And we've inculcated it, and you'll find Mexicayot from Canada down into Guatemala, and you can walk into any circle, and if you're a part of it, you know how to walk in, how to present yourself, and you have a place in the circle. And so in that sense, it is religious. It is a spiritual movement, but it's a powerful spiritual movement for people who have not had any place else to go, who have been detribalized over the hundreds of years and don't have any sense of where they belong, then they can come to Mexicayot and that's a place for them.
Yeah, the detribalization. One of the concepts that I came in contact with in your scholarly work was around the question of lateral violence and the impact of lateral violence. I'm a student of Fanon. I think Black Skin and White Mask was something similar to what you're doing, is to think about what makes the soul whole and what prevents the soul from feeling whole. And when I read about lateral violence as someone who's Puerto Rican, who occupies different levels of colonial violence and experiences different levels of colonial violence, that concept as it pertains to people who have been purposely dispossessed from land spoke to me. Would you elaborate on that and how that plays into the spiritual movement?
One of the things we say in our community is, who do you claim and who claims you? There are a lot of people claiming to be indigenous, but they have no community and nobody claims them. They're just profiteers. They write pretty little books that everybody's happy to read because it connects them with some woo-woo-ness, but they don't come from a community. There are native people who have tribal IDs, who have blonde hair, blue eyes, and white skin, who are not native. They've never understood racism. They don't know what it is to be brown in a white world. And so we have all these aspects. So in a legal sense, when you talk about the American Indian has treaty rights. They're not even civil rights, they're treaty rights. But we, as Chicano, Mexicano, indigenous peoples who do not belong, who have been detribalized even before the English speakers came through here, because we were stolen as children and raised as slaves, then we don't have that claim. We don't have that legal claim, but it doesn't take away from our indigeneity. However, the people who have been locked up on internment camps, in prisons, and have lived on those prisons for 150 years, have Stockholm syndrome. They're very, very attached to all the things that their prison guards have told them. They provided them with a prison ID number. Today, that's called a tribal ID. So when we're talking about tribal IDs, what we're talking about are prison numbers. We're talking about associations with prisons. So when the cavalry came out, they knew how many people were there and how many soldiers they needed to defeat them if that was necessary. That was the function of this. But today, Native people are very proud of their tribal IDs and feel like somehow or the other they're more empowered or they're more Indian than someone else, even if they have white skin, even if they are white people. They have a tribal ID and they somehow think that they're more Indian. That is problematic. It's absolutely problematic. And so I come from a community that eats the same food we've always eaten, that holds on to the same kind of values, that we respect one another within family and within community in the same ways that we always have done. But we were not locked up on reservations. My ancestors, when the white people came to lock us up on the reservation, they said, well, you're Indians, we're going to lock you up. We were like, oh, no, 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 señor, nosotros somos Mexicanos, right? We just switched the language. We had already been enslaved. We had to learn Spanish. We could switch and call ourselves Mexicano instead of Native. And so we could retain rights that were not given to Indian people until the 1920s. We could own property. We could vote. And we avoided the prison system. But that doesn't mean we're any less Native, right? So the idea of lateral violence is that you're not Indian enough, that because you don't have this tribal ID, or because the U.S. government doesn't claim you as an Indian, that you're not Indian. That's lateral violence. You know, my people, my community have says, we've spent a lot of time with Lakota in their ceremonies, but they always take the Chicano people and they make them do the hard work, because they don't really think of us as Indians. And that's a reality in the Native world. In the Native community, they don't want to have this discussion about who the real Native people are. People in Mexico are more full-blooded than the people in the reservations, right? And the reason is, like, I mean, if you talk about Lakota people, they have brown hair, brown eyes. Their black hair is gone. And the reason is because they were interbreeding with the French who came through there. And most of their names are French. So they're mestizos. They're Métis. But they, if you ask them, they're full bloods, right? And the people who really are full bloods, Mexicanos, don't claim their indigeneity. They're Mexicano, or now today they say they're Latino. But they don't claim who they really are racially and culturally, because of this lateral violence. And so our people, our indigenous people who are Native, who don't have a card, somehow or the other think they're not tribal people and that we don't have any treaty rights. We do. Under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, we have treaty rights. We don't always exercise them, but we are a treaty people and we are indigenous people, even though we're regarded as immigrants, as if this was not our land. So, yeah.
You're listening to Hemispheres on KGNU. We're having a conversation with Atek Paxin, Hinesado Apache, Curandero, and Reverend about lateral violence, indigeneity, and gringismo.
Thank you. So some of my political activists here in Boulder has been around Palestine and trying to get the ceasefire happening in Boulder City Council. I want to ask is that, what's it going to take for those rich white folks who are in power to be able to understand that if we continue to perpetuate the wound of genocide, because we have that history here, like, you attest to that. No one can tell you that that hasn't happened here and that it hasn't continued to happen here. My question is there a possibility for us to ever confront the wound of genocide and actually accept the level of accountability that we need to in order to have a whole soul healing.
The model of Armageddon genocide that has happened here in the Americas, all across the Americas, and it hasn't ended. People think that somehow or the other today things are good. They're not good. It hasn't ended. It has taken different forms. That is the model that was adopted by the English when they went after the Irish. It's the model that has been adopted by the Zionist community against the Palestinians, because it's a successful model for committing genocide and for oppressing peoples, oppressing communities. I went to speak to a class at DU recently, and they said, whatever you do, you're not allowed to talk about what's happening in Palestine. So I went into class and I talked about Palestine. Nobody from across the world gets to tell me on my land what I can and cannot say. And the Zionists are some of the worst. They have a very strong lobby in this country, such that people who are at universities, people who are in corporations, people who are in government, if they say anything that's contrary to the narrative that the Zionists are peddling, they get fired. And that's just not okay. It never will be. They are on the wrong side of history. And so when I talk about Christianity as being one of the issues around Gringismo, I'm not exempting Judaism. Some of the worst and most racist people are those who believe that somehow or the other they're chosen by God and that makes them better. First of all, there is no God and they're not chosen. They chose themselves and they continue to do horrendous things around the world against other people. And I've experienced that firsthand. So I'm not exempting Jews from what I'm saying about Christians. In fact, they're following the same exact model. The only difference is Jews aren't out recruiting. Christians are out recruiting. They want more Christians. But the issue is the same. You justifying your heinous atrocities, egregious atrocities against other communities based on your religion, because somehow you think God has exempted you from getting along with your neighbor, and that's in your teachings. That's problematic. And so we see that. And we understand that as indigenous people, those of us that have enough consciousness to recognize that's what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in occupied Palestine is not new. It's very real and it's very much like what we continue to experience here. Most native people that I know do not own land. And the people who think they own land on the reservations do not own that land. It's in trust. If you want to do something on that land, you have to get the permission of the federal government because that's really the federal government's land. So people have misconceptions about the casinos. Native people don't own those casinos. Large casino owners from places like Atlanta, from places like Las Vegas, actually are in cahoots and set up those casinos. Native people didn't set those up. They had to go, they get a small percentage of that, but they don't run those and they don't make decisions about those casinos. They don't own them. So this idea of ownership is an idea that's peddled by the capitalists, and it's an idea that's peddled by white supremacy. Oh yeah, you're sovereign, you have power. It's like, no, you don't. The first sovereignty, the first liberation happens in your mind. I say that when I write and I teach, I do so from an indigenous liberation epistemology. This idea that you need to liberate yourself first, and you need to get rid of all that junk in your head, so that you can walk with your head up and you can make changes in this world.
Thank you. Thank you. If you listen to the land, the land will tell you all the pain that it's gone through. I'm talking about Sand Creek, I'm talking about the Amachi, I'm talking about the KKK, the Rocky Flats, right? And that's just what I've been able to hear. And I've only been there for 3 years. Someone like you, I'm sure there's a whole other list of things. And I listened to your interview that you did with the Boulder Library. And one of the things that struck me in that interview was you talking about Los Seis de Boulder and how that was when the death of the movement happened, or you consider that to be a moment where everybody just packed up and became silent. I think about the case of Laura Gonzalez, who was put in jail for her political activism around Palestine. And I think about the ways in which, while it's not comparable to the death, and I'm not at all making the comparison, I am saying that there is a pathway that we're moving towards that could repeat that particular history. I'm curious if you can talk to us about that, what you experienced and how that has impacted our community and what why we haven't healed from that. From my standpoint, I don't think we've healed from that.
There have been countless assaults against our community. As I said, the genocide has not ended. So what's happening with ICE right now, where they're rounding up brown people and shipping them off to prisons in other countries that they're not even associated with, as a way to justify this administration and their greed and their white supremacy. This is not new. None of this is new. So in the case of Los Seis, as I said, we were at war in the Chicano movement. Our people were getting killed left and right. I know a number of people that died consequent or were jailed consequent to their involvement in the Chicano movement and the American Indian movement. There is a narrative that has been peddled around what happened with Los Seis, but I knew them. I knew most of them. I had spoken with them before they died. I was part of the movement that was happening with the takeover at TB1. And that could be a whole semester of teaching at the university if you wanted, just about what led up to all the events. But the bottom line is some of our people died. But I want to get away from the narrative that they were just martyrs or just victims. They were revolutionaries. They were ready to die. And that's one of the differences. And part of what's been taken away from Los Seis in terms of the narrative that's peddled today. They made a choice. They knew that they could die in their involvement. We had an issue the other day with the Boulder County decided they're going to distribute funds to communities that have been marginalized and not receiving equal funding and equal support around climate justice, around climate change and climate justice. So they put out a couple million dollars and they decided we're going to spread this out in the communities. The people that got that money, the majority of them were white people. It wasn't the communities that needed them. And they justified this under the Amendment 14, which is code language today for whites will prevail. Amendment 14, any reference to Amendment 14 means whites will prevail. That's how it's translated. That's not what they say. They say we can't discriminate on race, but you are discriminating on race because you're privileging white people again. So that's the language they use, and they gave white people this funding. So I got up, stood up, said what I needed to say, and they pretty much threw us out there, and everyone was worried about me getting arrested. I'm not worried about getting arrested. I stand behind what I say. I stand behind what I believe. I always have, and I always will. And that's a real difference between the people who have jobs and they're doing something revolutionary in their job. Theoretically, they have a big name for themselves, but they're not really in the community. They're not really involved and they're not really ready to go to jail or even die for the things they believe in. This genocide, I want to see a stop. I want to see an end to this genocide. And in order for that to happen, we have to name it. So when I talk about gringismo, and I don't say settler colonialism, because settler colonialism, one, they were never settlers, they were invaders. And two, it's a nice way of saying the white people, but let's call gringos what they are. They're invaders. They come with an ethos. They come with a way of being in the world that is just destructive. We're seeing that. Our democracy has been destroyed in this last year. But that's what they agreed to. Why? Because they want to assure the white people are privileged in this country. And that's problematic. And here's a teaching from our creation stories. And I won't give the whole story, but at the end of the day, what it says is when a world privileges one element, be it fire, wind, water, or earth, or it privileges one community, in this case, a white community, that there's an imbalance. And the consequence of that imbalance is always violence. And it doesn't create the harmony that we as Indigenous people strive for. Whether we like it or not, we are all here on this earth. And here in the United States, despite our diversity and despite wherever people came from, we're neighbors. We live next to each other. We need to learn to live with each other. And we need to get over this hatred and get over these ideas that somehow or the other, I'm more privileged than you are. All the racism, all the lateral violence, all the sexism, all the homophobia, we need to put those behind us. That's antiquated thinking. And we need to move forward. And part of the move forward is we need to support each other. We have all the resources we need in this world to feed and house everybody. And if there are people who are unhoused or hungry, that's because some people are greedy. If a monkey hoarded resources like Bezos does, we would think there's something sick and wrong with that monkey. But when humans do it, somehow or the other, that's something to aspire to. That's pretty sick behavior. That's mental illness. And yet that's society we live under. And it has to change. And I'm not advocating violence. I'm not advocating anything other than the fact that we need to learn to live with each other in a way that's respectful, that we walk with our heads up and we walk with all of the rights that we were born to, but not taking away other people's rights as we do so. And that's the balance that we're looking for.
I think we're coming towards the end of this, and I just have one more question. Understanding that there's so much distrust between the Indigenous communities on this land and white folks, what is one thing that white folks and those who are in positions of power, what is one thing or what are some things that they can do if they're looking to repair the damage, the harm, rebuild trust with your Indigenous community, particularly if you want to speak from that?
One of the struggles for those people who don't live on reservations, on these prison internment camps, one of the issues for Indigenous people, particularly in urban areas, is we don't have places to hold our ceremonies. Whether we want to dance, whether we want to go into lodge, whether we want to get married or hold funerals, we don't have spaces. This is our land, and we don't have access. So one of the most important things that I think that the white community can recognize is that, one, you don't really own the land. And if you want to build those bridges, you need to share. And by sharing doesn't mean you need to open up your home and give it to me. You can keep your home. But we have community centers, we have schools, there are churches, there are all kinds of places that sit there empty, that our community, if we had access to them, could absolutely take care of ourselves in the ways that we need to do. We don't need to be like all white Americans. We don't need to assimilate. We need to respect the fact that as Native people, we want to be different. If some want to be Christians, fine, go be Christians. But those of us who don't, we don't have to assimilate. We don't have to agree with all these other things. But we are paying the same taxes. The immigrants that are coming here pay the same taxes as everybody else. They have the same rights to access, and we don't get that access because of the racism and the way things are structured and set up. That has to change. That's a beginning place, right? People talk about land back, and that gets very complicated because of these ideas of ownership and land ownership and property that don't mesh with Indigenous thought. But at the very least, if we have access to the land, to the places that we need to be able to be ourselves, that's a good first step.
You're listening to Hemispheres on KGNU. We're grateful to Reverend Atekpatsin for his clarity, his courage, and his willingness to speak openly about history, genocide, and the ongoing struggle for sovereignty here in Boulder. And as we sit with his words, we also recognize how these same patterns show up in our political landscape today. Another example is the case of Laura Gonzalez, a local Indigenous activist now facing criminal charges for her advocacy. To help us understand the stakes of this moment, we turn to her attorney, Cameron Bedard.
Laura Gonzalez is currently facing charges stemming from protest activities. She has consistently urged Boulder to divest from companies profiting from military occupation and violence in Gaza. She zealously advocated for Boulder to pass a symbolic ceasefire resolution. These actions are actions that reflect Boulder's purported progressive values, or so you'd think. How has Boulder responded? Well, Ms. Gonzalez is currently being charged with a host of crimes stemming from her political advocacy. She's facing criminal charges and incarceration for using her voice to call attention to one of the most atrocious humanitarian crises of our time. You can't be neutral on a moving train, and Ms. Gonzalez has taken tremendous risks to advocate for causes that matter. Now, she's being silenced and muzzled by the state's criminal legal apparatus for activities related to her activism. You know, for people hearing about this case for the first time, it's not just about one activist. It's about the future of free speech in Boulder and cities across the country. If Boulder, a progressive city, succeeds in criminalizing peaceful protest via state prosecutions, it sets a dangerous precedent that speaking out against state violence or genocide can cost you your freedom, can subject you to carceral sanctions. The stakes are enormous in a case like this. Again, if Boulder, the self-purported city of progressivism, can silence dissent by way of state prosecutions against an activist for engaging in free speech activities, what message does that send locally, statewide, or nationally, at a time when people's rights and liberties are under siege by local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies? This case risks chilling legitimate debate and turning advocacy for human rights into a criminal act. Symbolic actions matter. They tell the world Boulder stands for peace and justice. Over 100 cities from Atlanta, Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis, Seattle, San Francisco, Providence, they've passed some form of resolution condemning Israel's atrocities in Gaza. Sure, activists know that these resolutions are non-binding. Nobody is proposing that these symbolic resolutions will end atrocities in the Middle East. But these things do matter because they increase the sense of solidarity. They call out atrocity when it exists. And Ms. Gonzalez and other activists that she has passionately organized with are trying to do just that. A case like this goes to the soul of what Boulder holds itself out to be. Criticizing state violence is not a crime. Yet here we are. What's troubling is this case fits a growing national trend of using the legal system to intimidate activists. I mean, across the country, we've seen peaceful protesters charged with serious crimes for exercising their First Amendment rights. Think about what's been going on in Atlanta with the Cop City protests. Think about the Dakota Access Pipeline protests that took place around Standing Rock. Need we go back to Occupy and protesters who had been silenced during that movement as well? But now, under the current political landscape, where federal forces and the current administration is galvanizing and weaponizing federal law enforcement agencies to go after political targets, the advocacy that activists are doing today is more important than ever. What's concerning is, how is Boulder, a bastion of progressivism, asleep at the wheel on one of the international issues of our time? And how is Boulder responding to activism at a time when free speech is under siege in cities and states across the country? One of the things that's been levied, and one of the characterizations that has been so unfair, is the way that the term anti-Semitism has been weaponized to silence voices challenging Zionist ideology. Criticism of government policy or military action is not anti-Semitism. Yet activists in Boulder are being smeared to quash legitimate dialogue. This tactic doesn't just harm people like Ms. Gonzalez and other activists affiliated with some of the Boulder advocacy surrounding the ceasefire resolution and divestment. It undermines democratic discourse and the ability to hold power accountable. That's exactly what Ms. Gonzalez has been doing. That's exactly what they've been trying to achieve. And now they're facing jeopardy for their outspoken activism. This is concerning. This ought to cause people to pause and deeply consider what is happening in a city that prides itself on progressivism and how activists who are outspoken are currently being quashed, quelled, and silenced by state prosecutions for their advocacy. Laura's case isn't just about one person. It's really about protecting civil liberties for everyone in Boulder and other cities. If we don't fight this now, the costs of doing so later will be far greater. More activists will be criminalized, more voices will be silenced. And what's so disappointing is a city that prides itself on progressive ideals betrays its own value system. You know, the right to free speech is contingent. It's not a given. And it's something that authoritarian forces would love to take away. Advocacy for human rights should never be a crime. Not now. It's more important than ever to stand up for the right to exercise free speech and to engage in political protest. Hug your local activists, thank them for advocating for solidarity on issues that matter in the city and across the world.
You can find links to Reverend Atekpatsin's work and teachings on the KGNU website. And we need your support as Laura Gonzalez faces criminal charges for advocating for human rights. Her legal defense fund is at tinyurl.com/LauraLegal. Again, tinyurl.com/LauraLegal. Thank you for listening to Hemispheres on KGNU. We'll be back next month with more conversations. Until then, take care of yourselves and each other. We'll give the last word today to Laura's attorney, Cameron Bedard, who tells us whether this case is winnable.
While I can't comment on the specifics of this case, a few First Amendment principles are instructive. Both the United States and Colorado constitutions forbid laws abridging free speech. That right isn't absolute, though. Governments can restrict speech that constitutes true threats or so-called fighting words. But courts have made clear that even harsh, vulgar, or insulting political speech is generally protected. People have a right to voice their opinions, they can be vociferous in their statements, they can be passionate, and that is protected political speech. To qualify as unprotected, speech must create a clear and present danger of serious harm, far beyond mere anger or annoyance. These are bedrock principles in First Amendment jurisprudence. Today, fighting words are essentially limited to speech that is so inflammatory, it's like dropping a match into a pool of gasoline. So when a protester calls out city officials for refusing to support a symbolic resolution condemning Israeli aggression, that's classic political speech at the heart of the First Amendment. And if such advocacy can be criminalized, what does that say about the health of our democracy? So, is a case, generally speaking, involving a protester advocating solidarity with oppressed peoples winnable? In front of a conscientious jury, absolutely.
Support comes from Tangerine Restaurants, with locations in North Boulder, Old Town Lafayette, and downtown Longmont, providing traditional morning fare and lunch with with Mediterranean and Tex-Mex twists, as well as espresso coffee drinks. More information and menus can be found at tangerineeats.com.
Support comes from Ozo Coffee, serving coffee in several locations in Boulder and Longmont since 2007. More information can be found at ozocoffee.com.
Support comes from Yellow Scene Magazine, Boulder County's source for local arts, culture, and news. More information is available at yellowscene.com.
This is KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. Up next is the cabaret program. Tonight we'll be featuring some highlights from some other in-studio performances we've had throughout the year on other programs, including the Morning Sound Alternative, Musica Mundi, and Schulte Gale. We're going to start off with Global Roots Ensemble, who visited Iris Berkeley on the cabaret show a few months back in September of this year.